From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Later in this episode, Leah Caldwell will join us to discuss her recent piece about a church revival gone awry in Wells, Texas. But first things first, we've got news to discuss. Joining me in the studio is Observer editor Dave Mann. Hey, Dave.
Hello.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi.
So I understand you guys are itching to talk about the governor's race. What's going on?
I mean, we talk about it all the time anyway.
We do talk about it like all the time.
But now we're going to do it on the radio. So today is Thursday, and Tom Pawkin has just dropped out of the running as a Republican challenger to Greg Abbott. But one of the things that happened this week that I thought was interesting is that Greg Abbott has launched his education roundtable tour of the state. And he started in Plano, which is sort of known as a leader in virtual schooling. He's going to San Antonio to visit a charter school there. And he's going to Weslaco to visit a charter school there. And this is where this is his fact-finding tour of the state in preparation for his education policy initiatives he's going to announce early next year.
And he dared to go to a school.
He did. Right. Yes. Yes. As we all know, Greg Abbott is public enemy number one in education because he stood up in court his lawyers, were up there in court defending the state because the state got sued over the school finance system. To my mind, this was kind of a goofy bit of political business this week that, because he went to the school, the Wendy Davis campaign came out against him saying, what business do you have in the school when you were, defending the state and its cuts to the school budget, which is his job as attorney general, basically. So, it's one way in which, this seemed like there was an opportunity there to maybe, for the Davis campaign to step out and say, well, hey, you're looking for education ideas for the state in virtual schooling and charter schools. What are your ideas for the rest of the school system? Or to maybe get into some more nuanced bits of policy discussion or even talk about how school finance should work. And instead, they kind of just jabbed him a little bit about how his job as attorney general and he was doing his job.
It was an odd criticism.
It's the one thing to pick out. It seemed like kind of a weak one.
Well, because, there's no doubt that you could criticize Greg Abbott for being part of the administration that cut funding for schools. I mean, it's not like Greg Abbott was standing up and saying, no, don't cut funding for schools. And he certainly did defend the state's position, although, as you said, I don't know, you can blame him for that since that's his role as attorney general. But, I don't know that there's much doubt that he would probably continue a lot of the policies we've seen under Perry. I don't know that if Greg Abbott were elected governor that we'd see some huge boost in state spending on public education. So I think it's probably legitimate to go after him on school funding or the reductions in money going to schools. But this seemed kind of awkward. Like if Greg Abbott he's not supposed to go to a school, like how dare he go to a school because he kind of defended the state in this lawsuit. It was an odd statement. I think it was indicative of kind of the awkward beginning to the Wendy Davis campaign that we've seen. Like this isn't, we don't mean to harp on this one incident. This is kind of playing into a narrative now that we've seen in the, 2 months since she's gotten into the race. We've seen some awkward attempts to criticize Abbott. We've seen some disorganization. There was that headline in the McAllen paper that was something like, "Is Wendy Davis ready for prime time?" Mm-hmm. Which kind of documented a slightly bizarre trip through the valley where Wendy Davis came out and declared that she was pro-life, which led to some confusion about what her stance on abortion was, when actually she was trying to say that, she's not pro-life like, anti-abortion. She's pro-life like she believed in life kind of thing. And
see, I think that was a really nice opportunity to have like a more interesting discussion and break things apart from just sort of talking points. And so much of what her campaign has been about so far has been reactive to what Abbott's been up to. And this, for instance, seemed like something where she was, it looked like she was getting ready to start a conversation and get something going. And then it kind of died out after that. And it left this hole for, you know, the conservative bloggers to go nuts about, you know, don't you know what pro-life means and who are you to say this? And it took on this look of some kind of a campaign, like a gaffe, which she had to clarify. And she just kind of let it hang out after that. And that was it.
And I think that these things are probably taking on more importance than they deserve because – I mean, you know, early in the campaign, there's always stumbles and you can forgive people from having gaffes and she's just getting started. And, you know, these things happen. And a year from now, when they're in the heat of, or 8-9 months from now, when they're in the heat of the race, no one's going to remember this stuff. But I think they're taking on maybe added importance or getting added attention because we're not hearing a lot of other stuff from Wendy Davis. I mean, for a long, you know, for months over the summer, she was like the media rock star. She was everywhere. She was on national cable television. She was all over the Texas press.
All over the Twitters.
Exactly. And since she started running for governor, she hasn't been nearly as visible. And that might be an understatement. I mean, Paul Burka at Texas Monthly wrote a blog post that was titled, "Where's Wendy Davis?" And I think that was kind of on point. I mean, she's been touring around the state, kind of listening to people and holding these events, and you just haven't seen much press about it. You haven't seen much free media. You haven't seen stories about what she's up to. And so I think there is this question out there among the media, among voters of like, well, where is Wendy Davis? And so when you get these minor gaffes, they take on added importance because it becomes like, where is the Wendy Davis campaign? Oh, well, here they are. They're screwing up. And that becomes the narrative because there isn't anything else kind of on the other side. And I don't know the reason for that. Maybe, you know, the campaign is trying to lay low for a while or they're just trying to get themselves organized before they roll out more of a media campaign. But whatever the reason, they've taken Wendy Davis, this kind of media rock star, and made her kind of, you know, taken her under the radar.
I like to sort of picture her as Tommy Carchetti in The Wire, you know, where some campaign advisors, you know, shut her in some closet somewhere with a phone and said, you can't come out until you make, you know, 5,000 fundraising phone calls and then we'll talk.
Yeah. I mean, and that could be. I mean, the fundraising is going to be a big part of it. I know that that's what they've been doing, but still, you know, you've got to be out there.
So publicly, what would you expect from them at this point?
Well, I just think that if they're going around the state, I mean, she's been making campaign appearances and going around the state, you know, doing events, and you just haven't seen much media about those events. And I'll give you a small example. Like when Letitia Vandeput announced that she was going to run for lieutenant governor, that same day, Vandeput came up to Austin and had a joint event with Wendy Davis.
Mm-hmm.
So here they are, the Democrats candidate for governor and lieutenant governor, two women.
Right.
Okay, which I don't think has happened in Texas history on a major party ticket. And I don't know how many times it's happened in U.S. history, but it's got to be pretty rare. I mean, this is an event. Here they are together. And, you know, the reporting that I saw, you know, the Observer reporter who was there said that they never really spent much time together. They were kind of in the same room for a couple of minutes, but never kind of posed together for the cameras. And so you never got that, like, local news spot where it's, okay, here are the Democratic candidates for governor and lieutenant governor together launching their campaigns, and here's the photo op. You never got that.
The kind of thing that the photographers were asking for, that like they knew was going to be, you know, catnip for anybody who was there just trying to get the shot and get this nice image of things. And instead they had somebody from the campaign in between them, I think, and they, you know, didn't even want the photo of them together.
And again, that's a small thing, but it's and it's something, you know, people are going to forget in a few months, but it's just indicative of kind of the narrative we've seen and how, you know, Wendy Davis has kind of been under the radar a little bit in the state, which is kind of just, it's just an odd thing after she was everywhere for a couple of months.
Right on. Thanks for sharing that story.
You're welcome.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining us via phone is Leah Caldwell, who wrote a piece for the Observer's December issue called Between Heaven and Wells. Leah, can you tell us a little bit about this piece?
Sure. Well, the story is about a group of young street preachers who came to the small East Texas town of Wells in 2011. They founded a born-again evangelical Christian church, and they named it the Church of Wells. At first, town, they didn't pay too much attention to the church, but soon residents started to become a bit aggravated when they noticed that members of the church were buying up more property in town, like the local grocery store. Members were also becoming more aggressive in their proselytizing, even though the majority of the town is Christian, the Church of Wells was very much convinced of their own brand of Christianity. And so to many, it felt like the church was taking over the town. 2012, the church started to get a little bit of media attention because the church member's baby died. And instead of calling 911, the Church of Wells held a 15-hour prayer session over the body and then called 911. And so this struck residents of the town as something that was a bit abnormal. They believed, or some members of the church believed at least, that you could possibly revive the body, or not bring it back from the dead, but revive it. Yeah, things didn't really get too heated until Catherine Grove joined the church. Like others, she came from outside of Texas. She came from Arkansas in the middle of the night on a bus, didn't let many people know where she was going. And her parents came down to Wells to visit her and to see what this new church was that she had joined. They encountered kind of immediate opposition from the church in terms of letting them see her. And her parents obviously thought this was very odd. And so they pushed harder to be able to see their daughter. And then the tension basically escalated to include the entire town. And this is when the allegations of the Church of Wells being a cult really began.
So her parents are still there, right?
Her parents are still there off and on. Yes.
Okay. And they're just waiting to see their daughter, I guess?
Yeah. You know, they've borrowed a trailer in town, and that's where they stay some nights. And, you know, the town has really kind of banded together behind the family. And yeah, they've been, recently I spoke to them, they've gone to every single house in the town of Wells, knocked on the door, basically asking if they've seen their daughter. You know, of the church members, I mean, many of them, most of them live in town. And so, you know, many people, yeah, are hesitant to provide any information about that.
Have they heard from her at all? Has there been any sort of contact?
No, there's been no direct contact.
Wow.
The only contact has been through the media, basically. She did an interview with a local reporter, and that's been it. The only contact has been indirect through media, through other church members, but no, she has not contacted them or any family member in any way.
Leah, I thought it was interesting that at first, you know, Catherine's parents thought this was something that'd be good for her. Oh, you know, she's joined a church, you know, joined this kind of religious community. Maybe that'd be something that'd be good.
They're both missionaries, right?
Right. Before they found out that, you know, they this church wouldn't let them talk to their own daughter.
Yeah. I mean, most of the members of the church, you know, they're pretty young, and most of them come from these devoted Christian backgrounds. And it's interesting because they leave their families, and they're basically looking for a more kind of authentic version of Christianity than the one they feel they've grown up with. So it's odd when they're, you know, it's basically like a reverse kind of parental rebellion, because they're taking these beliefs to the extreme.
Well, this is one thing I was interested about, because I was traveled out there to take some photos for your story and got to meet a couple of the church members just very briefly. But I was interested in how you were received as a reporter and what your interactions with folks in the church were like.
Yeah, well, at first I was received very, very suspiciously. My first interaction was at the gas station, just very kind of casual. There was no suspicion. I didn't identify myself as a reporter. I was just eating breakfast and hanging out. But then once I knocked on the church door and I was identified as a reporter, it was very different. It's such a small town. Like, I mean, I'm sure, as you know, once you're in the town and you're from outside, people can, you know, automatically pin you as an outsider. Yeah, so my reception was not very good at all. And but through email, it was better. I started speaking via email with Sean Morris. He wouldn't discuss any specifics about the church. He did want to talk about scripture. And as these email correspondences were going on, he would just write so much. And also, it was interesting. Like, you know, he told me he was very concerned for my soul. These kinds of things, you know, that he believes the Lord loves me and that the Lord is speaking to me. And it was interesting. You can kind of, I mean, I'm not going to join the Church of Wales, obviously, but you can understand the appeal of having these individuals, you know, quote unquote, feel that burden for your soul, and how they get new church members is online, through Skype, through Facebook, through these kinds of things throughout the country. And most of them are young girls. Many of them are young girls, but who've grown up in Christian households and probably been very sheltered. And this might be kind of their first interaction outside their family network with Christians, with people who share these same values. But I think maybe that once they get in the church, some might realize that, it's a much different environment.
And these church folks, I mean, they don't maybe look like what the stereotypical quote unquote cult members might look like. I mean, Leah, in your story, you talk about how somebody referred to the Church of Wales as the Church of the Hot Boys or something like that. And that these guys who kind of started and are leading this thing are these kind of like young, attractive guys who are very charismatic, and, you know, using the web and social media to recruit members. I mean, this seems like a kind of slightly different than maybe other kinds of cults that we've read about before, if they are a cult.
For me, I'm weirdly kind of neutral on whether or not they're a cult, just because I can really understand from both sides where people are coming from. But no, I don't think they would fit in the traditional model of a cult. For me, the two central questions that were important in determining whether or not they were a cult are the church elders, these three guys, these three, you know, hot boys, are they abusing power in a blatant kind of way that's harmful to people? And can people leave? The thing for me that was the most disturbing is kind of the emotional breakdown that a lot of the members, I think, went through with some of the former members who have come out and who have been able to leave. I mean, it wasn't necessarily easy for them to leave. One guy actually, like, just walked, like, from somewhere in North Texas, like back to his home in Houston. He just like left and walked.
Wow.
You know, he had no money. But one girl in an online testimonial, she wrote that the church had basically like kept her for hours, like in isolation. And when she'd come out of isolation, the elders would lecture and preach to her again. And basically her words were not her own. Her thoughts were not her own. They were, you know, she was being, you could say, brainwashed, if you want to use that word. She's basically being relentlessly preached to. And for me, that was the most disturbing aspect, that they're breaking people down to the point where you're no longer able to think for yourself. But I also think that people do go there voluntarily. I think that people are there by choice, and I think they're able to leave.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing the story.
Okay, thank you for having me.
You can read Leah's story, Searching for Souls in Wells, Texas, on texasobserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us in the studio is Mike Kanan. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So your latest piece for us is called What's Left and focuses on the changing face of Austin politics. How is it changing?
The 10-1 council will be elected for the first time in November 2014. When it changes, there will be 10 geographic districts, which is the first for the city of Austin. We've had for forever an at-large system where each of the council members is elected. You know, all of the voters in the city vote for each council member. The major shift is that you're going to have districts in the city, so geographic districts drawn as they would be in any other place, theoretically, for each of the corresponding seats. You're looking at 10 districts. A number of candidates have already sort of hinted that they're getting into the race, new candidates, new faces. You'll see some old faces too, but the big change is the way that things are going to get done.
So why has Austin sort of been a holdout for doing this? Because like most, not all, most if not all of other Texas cities are doing this already?
Most if not all. I think that, well, I should say that Austin's been a holdout because of, and this is what the story gets at, there's been in place what is locally called the gentleman's agreement. And you can picture the air quotes if you'd like. It's a deal that was sort of established in the late 70s as folks were emerging from Jim Crow. It was, as we say in the story, it was a deal between student progressives, and the business community that, and I think there's a line in there that I can't say on the radio, and that that Peck Young sort of sums it up really well. And the idea was for the students to get their, minority candidates elected to office, and the business community sort of would limit the I don't know if exposure is the right word, but the sort of voices that you would expect for minority candidates on the city council by agreeing to back two minority candidates, one African American and one Hispanic, in their respective races. The effect of the deal, however, for the next 40 years was that there were only one representative from the African American community and one representative from the Hispanic community on city council.
And this became like kind of a double-edged sword, because at the time it helped guarantee that the business community would not try to unseat minority candidates who got elected to city council. So in that sense, it ensured diversity on the council. But on the other hand, as you say, it kind of capped, as time went along, it capped, the number of blacks and Latinos who could be represented on Austin city council, because it's very difficult to run citywide. And at the same time, it prevented, any kind of like lawsuits over, or it prevented any court ruling saying you had to do these single member districts that other cities were doing, right?
At least it made it a lot harder for them to get a court ruling. Mm-hmm. I mean, they challenged the system there. I think there were three challenges of the system, but none of them were successful. I think we do point that out in the story. It just made it a lot harder to make the argument, because you've got these folks on, anybody in the establishment could sort of point to the African American seat and the Hispanic seat and say, hey, we've got this taken care of, Mr. Federal Justice. It's our right, and I think that ultimately what ended up happening, and as we say in the story, is there was a groundswell of community support for a change.
And it's not just, it's racial diversity, but it's also because it was citywide, you relied on a certain interest to fund campaigns. Like running citywide is, as you say in the story, really expensive.
Yeah.
And so it's not just limiting, the number of black candidates or Latino candidates who get elected to city council, but also the types of all kinds of candidates. They had to be endorsed by a certain establishment, political establishment. And so you had, it really limited, the number of new faces that could come
in. Yes. And that's another point that that Mr. Young makes. And I think it's a worthwhile one. In establishing this agreement, they sort of set a boundary for who was going to take part in politics, and that's reflected also in diminished voting numbers that you saw through the 70s and up until really recently. I think the stat is for our local affordable housing bond election in 2013, the one that just happened, we had 12% turnout and people were ecstatic, and I think that says a lot about what happened to voter turnout. I don't know that you can ascribe it all to what happened with the gentleman's agreement, but there's certainly, and then there's a study we cite in the story that certainly illustrates that it probably played a significant role in all of that. But yeah, it was very hard for new faces to break through for expense reasons, a very hardened status quo reasons, and I think that Mr. Young is very hopeful and this is sort of the closing quote of the story, that we're going to get somebody like Henry Cisneros or I think the other one that he mentioned was Julian Castro, and his suggestion is that without geographic representation, neither of those folks would have emerged, and both of them, of course, have become national figures.
That was one of the things that, I had sort of grasped the interest of, the interest of diversity. You'd want, the 10-1 plan made sense to me, and local or neighborhood representation, that made sense. But as far as opening up the city council to retail politics and forcing people to run these elections that were more door-to-door and more personal, that they would attract a different sort of candidate and somebody who was maybe had their sights set on higher office and not somebody who was happy to kind of keep pulling the strings here in Austin. I thought that could be a really interesting result of this change.
It is certainly it would be an interesting development. I think along with that, though, you'll probably also get, even if it's a temporary sort of thing where somebody has to invest in their community to get themselves elected and to jump to a higher office, you'll at least, I think, get a little bit more, I would hope a lot more interest in what happens locally. As I said before, the turnout rates here are sort of abysmal, and that's, I think, reflective of the fact that just not very many people are involved.
What other changes are likely to happen?
Boy, right.
I saved the Pandora's box question for the end.
That is a very difficult question. It's hard to see this far out. I think what we're gonna, you have, Mr. Butts is very concerned about the potential of incoming Republicans. We talk about that in the story. I think that we've heard as many as three. Three could get seats, District 10, District 3, and I think District 6. I think those are the districts.
Where are those districts? What part of town?
We're talking Northwest Austin, mm-hmm. North mm-hmm. and West, but Northwest too. The areas that you would think of if you look at the map and you look at the voting demographics and you're like, oh, right. But you'll certainly get the idea is that you'll get lots of new faces. At least that's the idea behind 10-1. Those new faces could theoretically be Republicans, they could be Libertarians, they could be who knows. I think that there is concern at City Hall, and we didn't so much broach this in the story because this is a Pandora's box, as you put it. There's concern at City Hall that the incoming council is going to be too inexperienced is sort of the way to put it, just not politically savvy enough to effectively run the city. And on the surface, that's sort of a suspect, criticism because it's coming from the establishment politicians. But if you really get into it and you really think about it and you think about how the city is set up and how our political system is, and in fact, Daily and KUT, we did a story about 10-1 and how it's going to change the way that the city manager has power. In Austin, we have a council manager style of government. There's no strong mayor. And that means that the city manager makes a host of administrative calls that can range depending on the experience and the interest level of council. The city manager is not an elected position. He's a hired official. He technically reports to city council. But the worry at City Hall is that the sort of chaos that may result from all of this could open up a situation where you've got a very powerful city manager pulling a lot of strings that maybe he wouldn't or she wouldn't. In this case, it's a he. Mark Ott is the city manager now. Wouldn't necessarily be pulling. And I think that there is significant worry about that. And I think it goes beyond an establishment concern. I think it's a real concern. And it will be interesting to see how the incoming council navigates that. That's going to be a real – it's going to be can I call it a spicy one? Is that okay?
I'm cool with it.
Okay, sweet.
Well, thanks for coming in, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can read Mike's story, What's Left, on TexasObserver.org. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.